And when council are ready, on the second matter today, Eckhart against Altella Inc., you may set up and proceed.
If it may please the court, I'm Lawrence W. Trees of Brownstein Hyatt Farber Schreck, and I represent the appellant Altella in this case. Let me start by giving you a little of the operative background of how the case sits. As the court knows, Mr. Eckhart brought an action for declaratory judgment to declare the non-compete invalid. The court granted summary judgment in favor of him on that claim. The court also awarded attorney's fees under a fee-shifting provision in the party's agreement. The fact is that the non-compete has now expired by its terms. There has been no further efforts to enforce it one way or the other. And so the issue here is really, in terms of operative significance, attorney's fees only, because the covenant not compete is over and does not operate as a further constraint on Mr. Eckhart's behavior. Obviously, if the trial court was wrong, as we say, in granting the summary judgment on the merits, say, on how it construed the contract provision, then the attorney fee judgment has to be reversed as well. Even if, however, the court were to disagree with our position and say the court did not commit error in how it construed the non-compete and what effect it then gave it in declaring the non-compete void from the get-go, even if the court were to hold that way, it still must determine whether the fee-shifting agreement applies at all. And we say it does not, and because it does not, the attorney fee award needs to be set aside regardless of what decision the court reaches on the merits of the non-compete provision. So I'd like to reverse the order you might expect and talk first about the fee-shifting provision, understanding that if the clock doesn't run out on me, I will have things to say about the other issue, which is the merits of the decision on the non-compete, which I think is well spelled out in our brief. In getting ready for this, I felt like I was back in the fourth grade parsing sentences for Mrs. Carter. But let me share some of that parsing with you. And I hope you can stand it, but this is a contract case on both issues, and the language is dense. Let's look at the attorney's fee provision first. It's quoted, for your ease of reference, on page 28. And it is not typical in my experience of the kinds that you see. What it says is that in any litigation or other proceeding by which one party seeks to enforce its rights under the agreement and prevails, fees are shifted.
Let me ask you this. If you won the deck action, you'd be saying you're entitled to fees because you would have thereby enforced your rights to uphold the validity.
Perhaps.
Well, in fact, you did, right?
What?
In fact, you did. In responding, you asked for fees yourself under the same
clause. In the pleadings, we asked for fees. We didn't get them. The issue of whether we're entitled to them, I think, is not congruent with the entitlement of Mr. Eckhart to fees for this reason. Mr. Eckhart brought an action not to enforce rights under the agreement, but to declare his obligations, not his rights, void. We did not counterclaim. We did not even ask in our, we did not counterclaim to foreclose him from work. We did not counterclaim even for a declaratory judgment to uphold the agreement. We did not even ask in our prayer for a declaratory judgment that the agreement was enforceable. All we did was defend his deck action. And arguably, defending a deck action that seeks to avoid obligations under an agreement that's been inflicted on you, we didn't sue, we didn't provoke this, is action to enforce our rights under the agreement by defending the deck, even though his action to avoid them is not.
Mr. Trees, you talked about parsing words. From Mr. Eckhart's perspective, when he asked to have his, when he asked for a declaratory action, isn't he in fact asking to have his rights declared, that he has a right to work, and the contract that purports to limit that right to work is void? I'm really having a difficult time seeing the distinction between that not being a right and actually suing under the covenant not to compete to be the only enforcement of rights.
Can I take you back to Contracts 101?
Please do.
You'll remember from Contracts 101 the difference between rights and duties. Rights were reciprocal of duties. The language here is enforce its rights. Rights mean enforce what the other party to the contract has promised or is obligated to do. So a suit to enforce rights means a suit to enforce the obligations of the other party who has the obligation reciprocal to the right that you are going to enforce. Mr. Eckhart here was not seeking to enforce or even declare, put aside the issue of whether a deck can ever be a suit to enforce. I will concede that an action to declare what your rights are, to obtain a favorable interpretation of what your rights are. And what the other party's reciprocal obligations may be, even though it's a deck, might fall within this provision. But this wasn't a deck of what his rights were. It was not under the agreement. Remember, the language is rights under the agreement. It's enforce rights under the agreement. This was a deck action. Not to enforce his rights by enforcing our reciprocal obligations, it was an action to declare his obligation, not his right, to declare his obligation unenforceable from the get-go, void ab initio.
Don't I have to read language into the contract to adopt that interpretation? And the language would be as follows, that you have a, you can collect fees under the fee shifting provision, as long as you are suing to enforce expressed rights and not implied rights.
I don't think so, because I don't think there is an implied right under the agreement to declare the agreement void and escape your own obligations under it.
No, it would be an implied right to work.
Well, we're not talking about an implied right to work. What we're talking about here is a declaration of whether a covenant not to compete, which falls within one of the exceptions to the covenant not to compete statute in Colorado, is nevertheless void, as Mr. Eckhart claims, under the general overriding provision that even covenants not to compete excepted from the statute are enforceable.
Since you're there, why don't you get to the merits of that argument, the one you began with in the brief?
The merit argument on
why this is valid, the merits kind of
This again is a contract construction case and involves interpreting words. There are two sentences in the agreement. The law that overrides the enforceability of agreements exempt from the statute is that the covenant not to compete must be reasonable in scope and duration. The first sentence of the operative language defines the scope of the covenant not to compete, the scope of the preclusion, precisely in terms of the law as to what's enforceable, which says it applies only if there's actual competition going on.
Let me ask you, Mr. Treese, if I may, because I don't want you to run out of time.
I'm getting close.
Yeah, I know. And the issue that I think your argument is you have to read the second sentence as kind of a subset of the first. The first one says competing business is business basically with whom that you guys compete. And then you have to read the second sentence to say all of that fits, you know, is limited by with whom you compete. Did I understand your argument right?
Yes.
All right. Then let me ask you, how do, in the second sentence, paragraphs C and D work with that analysis? C talks about research-based projects. D talks about products or services that may exist at the end of the term. We don't know if they're going to compete till the end of the term, and I understood your argument, and I get it as to A and B, but I'm having a lot of trouble understanding how it works with C and D.
With C, it would be that if the research project were one that, you know, firms compete over research and development. Microsoft and Google are competing over research and development right now. And a Microsoft engineer who left Microsoft and went to work for Google and was doing research on something competing with Microsoft's browser, say, even though neither one had products online that were competitive yet, would be engaging in competitive research. And so that really exemplifies why the second sentence, which is, this is the kind of business which, if competitive, is a competitive business within the meaning of the first sentence. And then D, is not the epitome of clarity, let me confess, but I would interpret D, and let me say this, that the maxim that the two maxims that are brought to bear that the trial court violated here is the overriding one that you should construe a contract so that it's enforceable, which enforces the seminal underlying intent of people making a contract, which is that they're creating enforceable legal obligations. And second, that contracts should be construed so as to give effect to all the provisions and should be construed so as not to render provisions in conflict. So the question you ask needs to be looked at through the prism of those maxims, and the way I would read D is that if it's in the business of products or services which, even though not during the term, fall within the first sentence, are, by the time the end of the term comes, within the first sentence, and therefore the agreement applies to what falls within D in the year following the termination of the contract pursuant to that extension, which says, you know, this says you can't compete while you're working for us. Then after you leave, you still can't compete. And if at the end of the term there is a product which, even though not during your term, would have been competitive, if at the end of the term it's competitive, then the year provides applies to that as well. And I just conclude with saying, if you parse through this and say, I can't get from here to there, that just means this is ambiguous. And that means, because it's ambiguous, summary judgment was improper, because we should have been allowed to present to the judge the evidence we had that the interpretation I just gave was what we meant, which Mr. Eckhart never met with any contradicting evidence in trial, relying wholly on the void from the get-go. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drews.
Good morning. Let me address the issue that Mr. Treese was just talking about. And
counsel, would you mind identifying yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. John Rehoff, registration number 11800 for the plaintiff and appellee, Clint Eckhart. I'd like to just comment on what Mr. Treese was talking about at the end, and that is the merits of the non-compete itself, and specifically, Judge Gabriel, I think it was your question about subsection D. It's interesting, the appeal in this case, I think, it appears that Altella understands, now that it's on appeal, that it has a covenant that's too broad, and it's trying to re-argue this case differently than it did in front of the trial judge. And I'll give you an example, which goes right to Part D, and I believe conclusively shows that, one, the non-compete is unduly broad, and two, Altella intends to enforce it that way. In our answer brief, footnote 5, we feature a thing called the scoping memo. Now, this is just a theoretical wish list that Altella put together to somehow conceive that someday it could possibly build a system which was 20, 30 times the capacity of the filters, the filtering mechanisms that it had built in its entire history. That was featured prominently in front of the trial court as the reason that Mr. Eckhart couldn't go to work for 212 in the first place. Now, that isn't even anticipated research. That's just a someday we're going to do this. And what's interesting about this non-compete lasts for 1 year. Now, at the time this issue occurred, was in August of 2008. Non-compete expired a couple of months ago, in August of 2009. Altella never argued, never presented any evidence, never offered any evidence in response to our argument that you guys can't even possibly do this within the next year. They conceded that, but yet they still intend to enforce the non-compete to bar Mr. Eckhart to going to work for that very company.
Counsel, let me ask this. The problem I'm having with the case as it was pled is it's a deck action. You're seeking, basically it's like a facial challenge to a statute. It's a facial challenge to this contract, saying that because it's too broad in this potential respect, it can't be applied in any respect. What case do you have? And I know you cited, I think, a Dilley case where the Court of Appeals said you have discretion not to reform it. But what case do you have that if it's overbroad in any respect or substantial overbreadth, that it's void on its face? It's basically cannot be enforced even as to, say, 212 or a direct competitor.
I'd be happy to give my brief. I actually do cite two cases in, I think, National Graphics versus Dilley actually does talk about that very point, that if the non-compete is beyond a reasonable scope, it is, in fact, unenforceable.
I don't think it says that. I think it says that the trial court has discretion whether or not to reform it, because you have the Supreme Court in Wittenberg that has reformed an overbroad clause, and you have a lot of other Court of Appeals cases saying that we're not going to consider whether it could be applied in this context. We're going to focus on the specific application that's at issue. And I'm just concerned with a deck action that's seeking a facial invalidity. I'm not sure there's any case that I've seen that said that is the mandatory relief in a summary judgment context.
Well, not in a deck action, I would agree. Could I just take a step back to kind of illustrate the facts? Because I think this case does. It does represent, I think, a typical way these cases get put in play. Mr. Eckhart went to Altella. Altella was having financial problems, and his salary had been involuntarily cut back, as a lot of senior executive salaries had been. He went to management and said, "I know you guys can't afford to keep a lot of us on the payroll, so I'd like to go work for somebody else, and I don't think this company really competes with what you do, because what you do is this little niche at the wellhead for these small capacity, low volume, low electrical consumption cleaning units. This company puts large cleaning units outside of a paint factory."
This company being 212 resources?
Being 212. "So I'd like to go to work for 212. Is that okay?" What he got hit with was a letter from Altella, and 212 did too, saying, "You can't do this." Well, if an employer is allowed just to fire that salvo and sit back, which it can do in this situation, what's the employee supposed to do?
Now, I suppose you can file a lawsuit for interference with prospective business advantage if you're convinced that the covenant not to compete is void.
You could, but the problem is if you decide to go work for somebody else because you don't want to put up with the issues that might be created by that, because you're talking about a one-year period here, and you're talking about a man who has to make a living for his family. So oftentimes what you do is you just simply, you know what, I'm going to go work for somebody else. And you'll see there's no evidence he actually ever went to work for 212 here. So at some point, the employee has to present his rights somehow. And the way he would present that would be to have a court at some point declare the provisions unenforceable. Even in your example, that would be the underlying legal finding the court would need to make, because there would be no claim for interference if the non-compete itself was enforceable.
But here's the problem. I guess you could come in and say 212 is not really a competitor under any definition. Or you could come in and say, I want to go work for a direct competitor because by trying to apply it to a non-competitor, they've overreached and it's therefore void, and therefore they can't enforce it even to a clear competitor. And I guess the relief you seem to be seeking in a deck action is he could go to work for any direct competitor. I don't know who it might be. I don't know if you can see 212 is or is not, but there's got to be at least some competitor of Altella. And under your theory, he could go work for the most direct competitor there is across the street using all his information from Altella, because this is overbroad and therefore it can't be enforced even to the clearest application.
But you're right. I mean, that is exactly what we were asking. But my opinion is the law supports that. Obviously, the trial judge's opinion is it does too.
But it's unusual when you can see that you're coming in here and you're saying, court, give it the broadest possible reading, because if you give it such a broad reading, it's unenforceable. And the company's coming in and their company's saying, no, read it more narrowly. It seems to be, you know, you're only making your argument about such overbreath because the next step, step two, is if you find it so overbroad, then you can't enforce it even narrowly. And it just seems to be kind of an odd way of litigating this case, where the employee is saying, ex-employee is saying, interpret this broadly so you can't enforce it at all.
Well, actually, we did ask for the trial court to rule that 212 wasn't in competition. The motion for summary judgment, the preliminary injunction that had just preceded that was on those two bases, but the summary judgment motion, it would appear to be an easier issue if you simply ask the trial court, is this thing enforceable? Because that subsumes the other issue. You don't even need to go there. You don't need to put on a trial as to whether or not this particular company, 212, would be in competition if, in fact, trial court finds that the non-compete's unenforceable. You just stop there and you go on. So
no,
it would appear to be a more efficient way to deal with it.
I'm not questioning that. I think I'm questioning the first thing you have to do is construe the contract.
Sure.
And you as the employee say construe it exceptionally broadly. Construe it so it says you can't compete with, or you can't go to work for a competitor. Interpret competitor to mean non-competitor. And you're saying give it a very broad construction, because then your step two is, once you give it that broad construction, you can't apply it at all.
That's correct, and I think that is a correct construction of the clause.
Well, how do you distinguish cases like Tallman, then? Tallman's been on the books for, 65 years, and it says we construe contracts to presume they're enforceable. And it seems to me your argument is directly contrary to that. That, you know, convince me I'm wrong here. You know, how is Tallman distinguishable?
Well, I would agree that that is a rule of thumb, but that doesn't mean that trial courts are always supposed to interpret contracts to find them enforceable. If in fact the language doesn't survive, if the language in fact does make the covenant too broad, and it's too broad, and I don't think our argument digresses from Tallman at all. I don't think it does. Our argument simply is this language presented to you, it's not ambiguous. It says what it says. Again, illustrating the point you brought up about point D, that opens this thing so broadly. You just say on the last day he's employed, we're going to go do this someday.
Well, why don't you, if you would, please respond to Mr. Treese's, and he responded to me, that, as I understand it, you're going to look at the end of the period, somebody, they developed a new product that is in direct competition, you know, some competitor. I think, you know, he says it's limited to competition. It does, the language of D does say that. I mean, it talks specifically any product or service in competition. So why, if we read that narrowly, why isn't that okay? I mean, I get that you don't know until you get to the end, but when you get to the end of the day while your client is still under the contract, the question is it a competitor? It's defined in terms of competitor. Why isn't, if we read it now?
I would agree with you that it's defined in terms of competitor, but I think the language that defines what competitor is takes it beyond competitors. That's our point.
Could you explain that?
Yeah. I pulled the clause here because I assumed that you were going to be asking me questions about it. Without limiting the generality of the foregoing, a competing business includes any business whose commercial efforts involve water purification, production, technology, and products. And you go on down here to D, any products or services in competition with products or services which are, at the end of the term, produced, marketed, or in actual or demonstrably anticipated research or development by Altella. Now, that would be items such as the item in the scoping memo, which this company doesn't have any reasonable possibility of producing. It can't fiscally afford it for starters, but it would be so far beyond that company's manufacturing capability that it's simply impossible. But that is exactly why Mr. Eckhart got the demand letter he got saying you can't go to work for 212.
Mr. Aaron, what would you say in response to Mr. Treese's argument that, you know, companies compete in research and development too, and your client was in large part responsible for that, for them? So, you know, why doesn't it apply if there's just, you know, demonstrably some research and development piece? So they're working on developing that technology. Your client is involved in that. You know, why isn't that good enough? It seems to me you're suggesting if the product isn't on the market, you know, and we have to engage in whether they could possibly get there, you know, not good enough.
If I am an employer and I manufacture servo motors, and I say to him that I am going to make an employee, that I'm going to make a rocket that will get you to the moon, and you can't compete in that area. Well, no, you're not. I say I am, therefore I am. That's what we have. We don't have anything that is truly within a reasonable probability of this company attaining. And you have to think about this within the scope of 1 year. Because Mr. Treese, I think, conceded this morning that Mr. Eckhart is a free agent today. It's a non-compete. It's not a non-disclosure agreement. It's a non-compete. So it has to be something that the company can honestly produce in a year.
So why doesn't that get us to a fact question then? I mean, it seems to me that just the meat of it, you have a real fact dispute as to what they can do and when they can do it.
Well, it's interesting. If we're going to look at the briefing that way, and we did brief that, and under the standards of a motion for summary judgment, we bring this up, it's up to the responding party to contest it. And I think if you review the briefing, I think you'll see they don't do it. I don't know how they can defend that. It's such fantasy land speculation. That would be a technology that would require this company not only to completely reinvent itself and build something it's never built before, and that's the individual cleansing units, but to do them in such a large array that it would be producing many times what it had done in its entire history within 1 year.
So your argument is you put on evidence here on for purposes of Rule 56, and they didn't provide
right.
anything in response. Okay.
Okay. I we've taken a lot of time on that. I guess things I want to talk about. That's what happens here. I really want to quickly talk about the fee-shifting clause. It says what it says, but it's the prevailing party when one party seeks to enforce its rights. Again, I don't know how an employee can enforce its rights when it gets those letters other than to file a lawsuit. It's got to seek emancipation somehow. It can't just sit there and let the status quo prevail, because then the new employer won't hire them. They got the demand letter too, and then judge your concern about the unintentional interference with contract claim, which is always the concern there, comes home to roost. But in the reply brief that Altella filed, they actually state on page 19, in defending this claim, the Declaratory Judgment Act, Altella is effectively seeking to enforce the covenant. They admit that they are. Well, we are the prevailing party. They're attempting to enforce it. The clause fits. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rehan. Thank you again, Mr. Treese. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.